State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbert Gilbertson presiding is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to our February term of court. Word of explanation before we start. Justice Salter has both an injured foot and managed to come down with a virus, so he is going to participate fully, but over the phone. Justice Salter, are you here?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good. Well, good morning to you, too. All right. And also, Justice Kern has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Scott Myron, a circuit judge from the Fifth Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota, Appellee versus Roger Jackson, Appellant. For the appellant, we have Ms. Alicia Fuller and Ms. Elizabeth Regalato, if I pronounced that correctly, I hope.
You did.
Good. I understand, Ms. Fuller, you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes.
Okay. And for the state, we have Ms. Sarah Larson, Assistant Attorney General from Peer. So without further ado, Ms. Fuller, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. For over a year, Roger Jackson and Kathleen Sheets had a relationship, and she was married. On November 18th, 2016, it became intimate, and they left the Bella Vista to go for a drive. They returned a couple hours later, and Kathleen was happy. Without explanation, a head-to-toe assessment was done, and she was asked a very personal question. Did you have sexual contact? To which, keeping her privacy, she said, I don't think I would do that. There was no explanation as to why the question was asked, and she didn't know the significance, and no one bothered to tell her. When she was asked the next day about this outing by her doctor, Dr. Beatty, she said, I had fun. No further questions were asked. Then she was taken to the hospital for an invasive sexual assault exam. No one bothered to tell her why. No explanation, and no one bothered to ask her about her encounter with Roger. And here is where the tears came. No one told her why, no one. No one interviewed her about it, and no one asked her what her thoughts were. She shared she missed him months later, but no one explained why her dear friend was gone. Her thoughts, desires, and feelings were dismissed. Now, the state's recitations of the facts should be read through the lens of the disease, through Benson syndrome. It should not be assumed that the lay person speaking of the symptoms knew why they were happening or what they meant. It should also be noted that the facts that were presented to the jury were limited due to the restrictions placed on the defense. And these restrictions permeate the case and resulted in Jackson not receiving a fair trial, and the jury was not allowed to hear the evidence to reach a just result. Now, why this case matters is that under the state's theory, any time a person is diagnosed with dementia, they can no longer consent to sex. Their thoughts, desires don't matter. Wives can be prosecuted for having sex with their husbands once there's a diagnosis. My grandmother could have been prosecuted for having sex with my grandfather after he was diagnosed with Lewy body's disease. It's a dangerous precedent to set to disregard what someone wants just because of a single diagnosis. Now, in addition, in this case, due to the failure of the state to investigate and interview the only witness, they took her voice, further taking her dignity. Now, I have prepared remarks for each of the issues in my brief that I submitted to the court, but I realize we're here because you have questions. I'd like to answer them. So if anyone has any questions, I'd like to ask them because I want to know what you want to know from me and what you want to know about this case.
Counsel, so, you know, in applying the test for when there is an alleged failure to preserve evidence or to provide access to evidence, you know, the issue is, was this information that was apparently exculpatory or potentially? And if you could address that, because it did appear from your argument that you were assuming that if she had in fact been interviewed, that that what she said would have been favorable to your client. So how do we get there from this record?
I believe that we know it was exculpatory because when she returned from her outing with Roger Jackson, she was happy. They had an over a year-long relationship. They had been very close before. And then before the sexual assault exam, when asked about her outing, she said, I had fun. But no further questions were asked to know, what do you mean you had fun? How did you have fun? Had it not been a consensual, or had she not desired to do that or had the capacity to consent to it, I suspect we would have had different answers to those questions.
But in fairness here, we have to look at, there is evidence in the medical records, is there not, with regard to her ability to communicate at that time, and there are comments about tangential thinking and not being fully aware of what was going on by the people that worked with her on a daily basis. So we do have to look at it through that lens as well, don't we?
Yes, and also through the lens that she was actively participating in therapy and receiving benefit from therapy at the time and long after she was attending therapy. There's evidence in the record that she misses someone, that she thought he was nice and he turned mean.
If we adopt your proposal that this is a constitutional doctrine, how far do they have to go in questioning somebody? Where do you draw the line?
One question would have been nice. I mean, that's the facts in this case are, they knew she could speak. They knew she was verbal. They knew she gave some answers to questions about what happened that night. Yet the investigator purposely chose not to ask any questions, not even go see her. There's no investigation on the part with the actual victim. Now, and it was contrary to their, and if the question is you can only get to exculpatory or potentially exculpatory, we go to bad faith. It was contrary to the sheriff's policy. There's a place in Rapid City where they get to take people that are children or special needs or mental illness and ask them questions. They didn't even bother to try to ask this woman what her thoughts were about her encounter with Roger Jackson.
Well, I want to ask about the investigation. If are you claiming bad faith by law enforcement or simply incompetence or ineffective investigation? Because, you know, following the rule may not be bad faith. It may just be we didn't follow the rule, we didn't do our job. Mm-hmm. That's different than bad faith. So what's your basis if you are arguing bad faith? Tell me where that's coming from.
Well, I am arguing bad faith, and if I can only get this court to agree that it was potentially exculpatory, that's the burden that I have, is to establish bad faith. One factor I think is the contrary to the sheriff's policy. They knew about Kathleen Sheets and that she was verbal, she had a memory, she could speak, and they just chose not to interview her. And as I stated, there are places that they have interviews. If this was a 3-year-old child, they would have attempted to interview. But this was a 55-year-old woman, and they just disregarded her thoughts. They chose not to, and I think it was bad faith, largely due to the relationship of Kathleen Sheets' daughter to the sheriff department. She was a former officer. They knew her. They knew her well. Everyone involved knew the daughter in this case, who directed, you don't need to interview her.
So she was taken for the sexual assault evaluation, and there is an interview component of that evaluation, which indicated that she didn't respond to these detailed questions as to what actually occurred. And in fairness, if law enforcement saw that, how do you then jump to bad faith for their relying upon a medical professional indicating that she couldn't answer those questions?
I think when you noted in the record, the actual trial, the testimony was, we didn't really ask her. We asked her one question at the start, then just stopped asking her any questions. So there was not a real interview at the sexual assault exam. And as I stated on the record, they never told her why she was there. They never asked about Roger. They just said, hey, we're going to do this.
Ms. Fuller, when I think about bad faith, I tend to think about an effort to subvert justice, an effort to suppress the evidence that otherwise the state knows or should understand is exculpatory. When you answer Justice Jensen's question, some of what I heard, maybe most of what I heard, was just sort of a reaffirmation of what you believe to be the errors of the investigators. Just sort of, this is what they did wrong. I think maybe wrong, but maybe you disagree, but doesn't bad faith, suggest something beyond just getting it really wrong, in your view?
That's a difficult question. I think that what they did was, yes, it was really wrong, but I also believe that their actions due to their relationship with the daughter drove this, and I think that was bad faith. It's not just like, oh, we accidentally forgot to interview. The officer that arrived on the scene, Triad Strobel, assumed another investigator was going to interview. It's Investigator Bowl made a conscious decision to not interview the only witness to a crime, and that's, in my opinion, is bad faith.
And so the theory there is that the police officers overlooked what would otherwise have been evidence of an exculpatory nature because of some allegiance to the daughter?
Yes.
Is there a basis for that on the record, or just sort of that's what you're putting together and drawing an inference from? Which is fine. I'm not critical. I'm just saying, where do we look for that?
I think that when you look at the fact that the daughter called 911 and said you don't need to interview her, and then spoke to Investigator Bowl and highlighted things she wanted to highlight that her mother told her, I think that you don't need to interview her, I think that was, I don't know why they chose to do it. The only thing that makes sense is they just relied upon a retired law enforcement officer's opinion, and I think that was bad faith.
Does the family's direction here to the officer have any weight? The family says, you don't need the interviewer. Well, that could be taken as a directive. We don't want you talking to mom.
I don't believe it carried any weight, or it shouldn't have. They'd still interview people that were witnesses to crimes. If she had been a witness to some other assault, she would have been asked the questions. But she was she participated in a sexual act, and they don't bother to ask her why, and I think that was bad faith.
There was a request, I think, from the defense, maybe on the second motion to dismiss, to take testimony, and the court denied that. Was there any kind of offer of proof, bad faith, or anything like that submitted at that point?
I did not submit an offer of proof, but my motion to dismiss was highlighted the facts that I believe could have been established. But I think in order to reach the burden, because it is Jackson's burden to reach, was it exculpatory? And I think the court needed to hear from what the officer knew at the time, who knew it, who told them to be able to meet that exculpatory burden. And I think also we needed law enforcement on the stand to be able to discuss their bad faith.
And didn't you ultimately elicit that testimony at trial?
A lot of it, yes.
And then you made your motion again.
Which was dismissed without argument.
But ultimately the court got to hear what you would have presented at the hearing.
Yes, in addition to everything else, it wasn't as focused as it would have been at the motion to dismiss.
Can we move to your issue with regard to the expert testimony?
Yes.
You refer to this handbook quite a bit in the brief, and was the handbook itself part of the record? I did not see it.
It was not. The court asked for the authority, and I sent it to the court. So the court had it to review, as did the state, but I made the mistake of not marking it as an exhibit and having it in the record. So this court didn't have the benefit of reviewing it.
Okay. And what do you think was the most pertinent for your argument restriction placed on the expert that you believe would have had some impact on the trial? Because you argue a number of different things there.
I think the impact was cumulative. Dr. Swenson's testimony kept getting more and more restricted as we went. It began that he was not allowed to speak about sexual capacity to consent. And then we add that I couldn't even use that phrase.
But ultimately, you got to ask that question.
I got to ask a very specific, limited question, yes.
But it had to do with whether he had an opinion as to her capacity to consent to sexual activity or something of
yes.
that sort. Okay.
Yes. And he was restricted as from the areas he would have asked or liked inquired or liked to see in the record with regard to being able to make the decision. And he was limited on speaking as to the differences in capacity, financial decisions versus intimate decisions and the differences. And he was limited in the morning of trial or the eve of trial, we were limited on scope and time. And why that's important is there's in the record 3, 4, 5 months down the road where she's still participating in therapy. She's still receiving a benefit. She's asking to see her, you know, she's still functioning as a human being with decision making and desires. And as everyone clearly said, the disease only gets worse. So if she's able to do that 3 months later, we could assume that she could have done that at the time as well. And the jury was, we were restricted to a very arbitrary time. And I think that was a very significant issue. Because, I mean, the ultimate issue is could she consent to sex on that day? And his expertise in the field and his testimony would have helped the jury assess all the information they were hearing and apply it to the factors. And they weren't, I wasn't allowed to do that. And he wasn't allowed to speak to that.
Dr. Swenson was able to testify about much or maybe all of what you just described, if I'm recalling the record right, Ms. Fuller. In other words, he was able to say, as you have, that, you know, there was therapy, and with therapy and programming comes the inference that there's some benefit. And so that was all explained, and that was part of very much part of your case. So he was able to say that, but that may not be as satisfying as you think it should have been, perhaps.
That's correct. It was not as satisfying as I thought it should have been. I think the jury was lacking information to be able to make a just decision, and that was due to the restrictions. One of the factors is due to the restrictions of Dr. Swenson's testimony.
I'm assuming the flip side of this, and we'll hear from the state's position, but if that time frame had been expanded then would that not have also opened up the door for the state to then elicit testimony from the medical records that may show deterioration or use the fluctuation in her capacity to argue their side? So you may have good and bad with that.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't that be possible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. But I think what was... There were a few items, and the fact that she was still continuing and receiving benefit from therapy months later suggests that she had a higher level of functioning and capacity to consent than was true, that was presented to the jury.
Can we, Ms. Fuller, talk a minute about the mens rea knowledge element? Do you think we have to reverse Schuster in order to... determine that there's a knowledge requirement in this case?
Yes. I think the Jones court did a better analysis than the Schuster court. And in this case, because they were looking at, we start from the presumption of mens rea, unless it's those strict liability kind of cases. And ultimately, when you look at Schuster and the facts of Schuster, we had a 16-year-old with a mental capacity of an 8- to 9-year-old that was static. That wasn't changing. And when we're talking about mental incapacity of someone with dementia, which we have to really be concerned with in today's aging population, it's not static. It's fluid. There's moments of great lucidity and capacity to make all the decisions. Some people wait for moments where someone is lucid and doing well and has a high capacity to sign a will.
So are you saying the rule should be maybe some cases there is a knowledge requirement and some there isn't? Or would you just flat out reverse Schuster?
I would flat out reverse and say there should be a presumption of knowledge, because even the static cases, it's known if someone has that capacity. They should have to establish that the person knows. Otherwise, we're criminalizing innocent conduct.
But do you think we can distinguish Schuster?
To a certain extent, because of the progression of dementia versus a mental incapacity of a 16-year-old.
Well, Ms. Fuller, I'm sorry, go ahead, forgive me.
Since Jones has been decided, my memory serves me that there's been a bill introduced in the legislature to reverse it every year. It has never passed, but obviously it has not gotten universal acclaim.
Yes, and the legislature could choose to do that. I think it would still be an error, and I would probably argue that that's an unconstitutional statute at that point, but we're not there now. This court has the power, as it did in Jones and Stone, to read that knowledge requirement is because the presumption of knowledge, because the presumption should be for a mens rea. And if not, it violates due process.
Justice Salter, do you have a question?
Thank you very much. On this topic, Ms. Fuller, and I've no disagreement when it comes to the presumption of mens rea. The cases support that, of course. And what I'm thinking about are what I would call the Staples, Morissette, Lipretta cases, where the United States Supreme Court has suggested that. But in Morissette and in the excitement video case and footnotes, the Supreme Court also acknowledged that at common law, there is an exception for sex offenses. And the one that they mention initially is the one for children or minors. But in Morissette, they also mentioned that, as they say, the absence of intent also involves considerations such as lack of understanding because of insanity, and then an archaic term here, subnormal mentality, and some other examples as well. Is it possible that something like that, and I'm not saying that's the answer here, but wouldn't we have to also consider that exception, which has common law roots, when we're trying to determine whether the presumption of mens rea in the absence of statutory text applies?
Yes, but I don't think dementia is age. It's not a finite line. So I think that when it's raising to the level of a dementia or a mental disorder, or in the case of the intoxication, it's fluid and changing.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired. Okay, Ms. Larson, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. As you stated, my name is Sarah Larson. I'm representing the state here. There seems to be a very large factor that we're missing, pertaining specifically to the facts of this case, that we are dealing with a formally diagnosed dementia patient who was deemed vulnerable by the defense expert who was raped, where we have the defendant's DNA, and a defendant who admitted to having sex with the victim. It would do this court a disservice to not at least briefly touch on the extent of her disease and her condition. This very special victim, who I consider someone who has touched me greatly, as I've had this file on my desk for over a year, and I really didn't want to ever have to open it up again. This case affects her, who I'll refer to as KS, and people like her who lived very active and successful lives, and then a disease wiped it all away. KS, in my mind, was me, and was you, and your wives, and your sisters. She was a college graduate with a very successful career in academics and public service. She was the type of mother who had high expectations for her children, raised a doctor and a law enforcement officer and a business owner, and yet was the type of mother who her adult children still referred to as a best friend, and then it all slipped away, starting with telling time and doing simple math and not understanding a remote and leaving the gas stove on. It's important to note that her family attempted for 7 years to care for her on their own. She was finally formally diagnosed with a rare degenerative dementia called Benson's disease, as we know, placed in assisted living in 2012 when she was only 52 years old. There, Roger Jackson met her. He had lived in Rapid City for a few years, did odd jobs here and there, but on Friday nights his band would play music at the assisted living facility, and he took a liking to KS, danced, sang together. When her conditions worsened, she was transferred to a high-level 24-hour care, locked-down nursing home. At that point, she had no control of her bowels, was in adult diapers 24 hours a day, would fall out of a chair while seated, could not understand how to sit down if asked to do so, struggled walking, would hallucinate, could not feed or clothe herself, could not brush her teeth, could not brush her hair, could not recall words, but throughout all of it remained positive. Her nurses described her as very happy all the time. Her most direct nurse said she doesn't refuse whatever is asked of her. Notably, when Jackson didn't see her any longer at the assisted living facility, he asked around, found out where she was, and followed her to the nursing home, continued her visits, his visits there, which became more frequent until nursing home staff became concerned and discussed that frequency with the family. Jackson was ordered by the family and by the nursing home facility that he was never allowed to take KS out of the facility. And yet he was there when her daughter came to visit and stated that she and her father would be out of town for the weekend, the first time they had ever left her alone, because they thought she was finally safe. She was in a locked down facility with these rules established. And then, as we know, when nursing home staff rushed to assist another patient, Jackson took her. They left the facility. Alerts went off. Police were called. Hours later, he returned her. And as was policy, staff did a head-to-toe examination, and her adult diaper contained what appeared to be seminal fluid. Jackson denied everything until he asked how the DNA results came back, and then he admitted everything. He admitted to having sex with her. He stated they were boyfriend-girlfriend. He said she consented. He said she was horny, that she wanted it, that she undressed herself. She pulled his hand to her, he said. And after being convicted by a jury of third-degree rape, Jackson raises several issues on appeal. I will try my best to touch on everything this court has referred to thus far.
Counsel, if we could, since we do have limited time, on the first issue with regard to the failure to preserve argument that the defense has raised, your brief focused primarily on the statutory grounds for dismissal. And in reply, defense pointed out that they were focusing on the due process motion that they filed. And so I want to give you the opportunity now to address the Trombetta and the Arizona v. Youngblood and those factors that are required where those claims are made.
Thank you so much. I did. I focused most of my constitutional arguments in the final issue as opposed to the separate one, because many of the things that are alleged do have the same test. But that test being that exculpatory evidence must create a reasonable doubt that didn't otherwise exist, and that there also be a reasonable probability that the verdict would be different had the evidence been disclosed to the defense. There seems to be this misunderstanding regarding this alleged failure to interview. Much of the substance referred to before, I don't recall being in the record. However, very clearly in the record and presented to the jury at trial were both exhibits 8 and 9, which touched on the questions that were asked of the victim, which were, are you in pain? Do you know where you went? Was there sexual contact? Do you feel okay? Were you kissed, licked, penetrated, ejaculated in, slapped, kicked? All those were in the medical interview, some of which she had answers to and some of which did not. The main basis being that whether this interview done particularly by law enforcement, creating a reasonable doubt that didn't otherwise exist. So far, the trial court determined, and everything I've reviewed in the record is entirely speculative. There's no suggestion whatsoever that KS's answers would have been helpful to Jackson, nor that they would have been reliable had she provided anything additional or otherwise that she already did. For example, the question about, do you know where you went? She answered, to the school where we always go. And it was her husband, who is a high school principal. She had never left with Jackson before that. In addition, I do agree that since exculpatory, the exculpatory was never determined at trial, she does carry, or Jackson does carry, the burden of proving bad faith. Again, none of which was provided. She argues at some point that there was a denial of an opportunity for an additional hearing, and also no basis for the denial. It's worth noting in the record that the basis for the denial was thoroughly addressed and issued by the court on the December 17th hearing. But all in all, there were four hearings granted: December 17th, January 11th, February 8th, February 15th. And at all of them, the trial court asked, is there any support you have whatsoever for a constitutional basis for granting a motion to dismiss on these grounds? And the trial court's exact question being, do I understand that your position is, had the alleged victim been interviewed, from that interview evidence, we would have obtained from that interview alone that the alleged victim was capable of consent? The response was yes, and again asked, do you have any authority for that position? And the answer was that the expert would state that, because the question of, do you know what happened and what are your thoughts about it, was never asked, he cannot formulate an opinion one way or another, which did not meet the burden that the court needed in order to grant that motion. In addition, the element of a reasonable probability that the result would be different, again, touches on the speculative nature of this entire argument.
Can we move to the second issue then, the mens rea issue?
Sure, yep.
And so, how do you distinguish the offense in this case from the incapacity for intoxication in Jones?
Yeah, regarding issue two, I'll just jump directly to that. I think it must be noted that this court has reiterated time and time again, most recently just a couple weeks ago in its Armstrong opinion and Robinson opinion, that a court is not at liberty to read into a statute language which the legislature did not incorporate. The language here, as this court held in Schuster, is clear and certain and unambiguous. In state.
So are you asking us to overrule Jones?
I believe that if this court feels that it must put great weight on Jones, I would ask this court to reconsider the holding in Jones, yes. This court has perfectly clear precedent, as we know in Schuster, that the defendant's knowledge of a victim's inability to consent is not an element of rape under this subsection, nor may the lack of knowledge be asserted as a defense. In fact, Jackson presented to the trial court that exact statement at the while reviewing jury instructions. Jackson's counsel stated on the record to the trial court, I quote, I think the defendant's knowledge or lack thereof is obviously not a defense. Continuing on later in that page, they stated, we are not arguing Mr. Jackson didn't know she's incapacitated, so it's okay. Certainly, we would not argue that. Still, Jackson asked this court to mimic the authority it exercised in State v. Jones. I urge this court to realize this is not Jones, neither factually nor legally. In Jones, we had a group of young people out celebrating a 21st birthday. The victim, alleged victim, was incapacitated, passed out during the act of sexual penetration, and the defendant in that case maintained all along that he didn't know that she was intoxicated. Here we have a severely disabled victim with a formally diagnosed physical and mental illness who had been in assisted living or
now,
nursing
Jones,
home.
If I remember right, the defendant was also intoxicated.
Correct.
So there was a question of his capacity to comprehend what was going on besides the victim.
That is correct.
is that a distinguishing matter from this case where, my understanding of the record, there's no allegation the defendant here had been drinking?
Absolutely correct, yes. Here we have not only...
Is that a distinction with a difference?
It's a distinction in support of the notion that Jones need not be applied here. Yes, you're absolutely correct that the defendant...
Ms. Fuller, can I interrupt real quick? So I want to go back to what you'd said about Schuster a few moments ago. And I thought I heard you talk about, even with reference to some of our more recent decisions, that this is a matter of textual interpretation. And if the legislature hasn't provided for a mens rea requirement, then it simply isn't there. That is Schuster, of course. But as I mentioned when I was visiting with Ms. Fuller, we do have due process requirements that I would think are applicable to the states, either by virtue of our own due process clause, which we've recognized is essentially the same as the one in the United States Constitution, or through the 14th Amendment. But the due process requirements of that line of cases I talked about, Staples, Morissette, Liberetta, there are others, they all are premised on the idea that even if a legislature or a Congress does not include a mens rea requirement, that doesn't necessarily end the inquiry. We have cases that say that as well, not just Jones. So are you sure that we can just read the statute and leave the issue alone? Or don't we have to consider the possibility that due process may require us to dig a little more deeply on this issue?
I absolutely believe that this court can read the statute as is. This court just very recently reiterated this terminology in Armstrong, that the fact that a statute does not specify any required mental state does not mean that none exists. Again, the statute specified that only that mens rea which is necessary to separate wrongful conduct from otherwise innocent conduct need be added. The jury was instructed that Jackson had the criminal intent to do the act which the law declares to be a crime. That act was that of sexual penetration with a woman who was incapacitated, and Jackson admitted to having sex with a victim, and there is no question as to his knowledge of the act. This justice system does begin with the assumption that all adults who have sex with someone do so consensually and in good faith. However, when a person believes that he or she is engaged in sexual contact with an 11-year-old, we fiercely protect that child, knowing that even if he or she wanted to have sex, that child does not have the requisite mental capacity to understand the nature and consequences of that act. And it is the same case here in countless scenarios. Sexual penetration with someone who's mentally or physically incapacitated is tied to and assimilated to and likened to statutory rape for a very great reason, and that is because our victims are similar, incapable of understanding what's happening, incapable of vocalizing opposition. In this case, very much
right, the physical hang on, effect hang on. Is there. Ms. Fuller,
capable of physical.
Ms. Larson.
Yes.
Ms. Larson. Right, but my question was, we can't just say, as we did in Armstrong, we can't just say here, well, we're just going to read the statute. Don't we have to also consider whether there is innocent conduct that could be captured here? And I think if I'm hearing Ms. Fuller's argument correctly, I think she's saying, hey, there's a spectrum of capabilities and capacity for various types of folks who have dementia. And if we affirm here, or if we just read the statute and say, well, that's good enough and there's no mens rea element, we could impose a categorical rule that, you know, a dementia patient can never, under any circumstances, consent. And I think her argument is, you know, that may be an improvident rule. What do you think about that?
Oops, I'm so sorry. Two things I absolutely must touch on there. First of all of that evidence was presented by the defense's expert to the jury, who had the opportunity to view all of the circumstances as a whole, all of that testimony as to her ability, that she still had some degrees of capacities, all of his testimony was there. Secondly, this court went out of its way to specifically categorize age with mental incapacity in its Jones opinion, stating that these portions of the statute justify strict liability for those who take advantage of such incapacities. I think there needn't not be this reluctance to allow the legislature to create strict liability crimes. They exist and they always have. The law exists in facets and multitudes, and courts must assume that the omission of a different mens rea element is intentional. As this court stated in Stone, we must read a statute as constitutional if at all possible. One other thing I wanted to touch on regarding your question, Justice Salter, also is this suggestion that anyone who's diagnosed with any form of dementia or any form of mental incapacity all of a sudden can be a victim under this subsection of the statute. And that does a great disservice to the language of the statute. It's not any form of mental incapacity. It's not any mental illness or mental disease. It is mental incapacity, defined as the inability to understand the nature and effect of one's acts. That is complete mental incapacity. It's not to suggest that anyone with any form of dementia who has sex, this statute will apply to. That is not the case. The jury has the ability to view the facts of each case and make that determination themselves. They did so in this case. Any other quick questions? Again, I would urge this court that if it does mandate that Jones be applied, that this court reconsider the decision in Jones. Yep. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Okay, Ms. Fuller, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Kathleen Sheets is not a child. This notion that mental incapacity equates to age, it does her a disservice because she's not a child. As the state highlighted for the first 5 minutes of their argument, she had a life, she had knowledge, she had love, and she had family, and she is not a child that we need to protect and define this clear line. She was a woman that had a relationship with Roger Jackson. And we can't equate dementia to age. To not have a mens rea on this offense is a due process violation. The bottom line is, if it's not a public welfare statute, which is what it's not regulatory public welfare statute like speeding. We're criminalizing otherwise legal and innocent conduct. And this punishment in some ways is extremely severe because he's in prison for a very long time as well as a lifetime of registration. The punishment is severe, and therefore to exclude mens rea does a due process violation.
Couldn't you make a similar argument, though, even with the age cases where you have a 15-year-old who looks like an 18-year-old and a defendant comes in and argues, I didn't know that she was 15. Should we not apply strict liability in those cases then either?
No, I'm not saying that at all. The 15-year-old is 15 years old. There's no changing that age. It's a defined, clear line that says in our legislature, and in that case, it should be strict liability. Because it's not changing. That person does not have the ability to consent in any sense of the world under our law. So no, I don't believe that age should not be strict liability.
But isn't that just a factual degree of certainty?
Yet they're all subsections of the same statute, and they don't distinguish between the various forms of disability in the statute. But you're saying there is a distinction between age and the case we have here.
Correct. There is a distinction. There are four subsections within the same statute.
Right.
Age is one, mental incapacity is one, and intoxication is another. And this case reads, and the statute reads, pretty much consistent with the intoxication statute. So there is a distinction, and I think it's a clear line. Age is a clear, definitive, static thing. Dementia is not. Mental incapacity is not. I mean, in the Jones court, you did the analysis that, in the factors here that would note that the Jones court should apply is that it's not that conclusive presumption, that finite thing. There's no definition of mental incapacity in the code. The court did define mental incapacity. We don't have to define age for a jury. We just present age. And if knowledge is not an element, then we're imputing knowledge of an expert onto every single citizen to understand what's happening in that brain that they're not equipped to understand. And the fact that we need an expert in medical records to explain what that mental incapacity means makes strict liability extremely problematic.
Do you care to respond to the state's request to overrule Jones?
I think Jones was correct. I would ask the court not to consider overruling Jones. I think you did a very thorough analysis that applied the Constitution and other case law. And I understand the dicta in Jones the dissent in Jones maybe wouldn't have found the same, but I think the majority of the court did the correct analysis.
Justice Alter, do you have a question?
You know, no, thank you. I'm fine.
Okay.
I think I've got it covered. Thank you.
All right.
Ultimately, in Jones, the court didn't actually end at knowledge. The actual mens rea in there was know or reasonably should have known, which is actually a negligence standard, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, and I think that's a reasonable reading. But the fact is, the state should have to prove that, and we can't assume knowledge on every citizen. Are there other questions? I had other remarks that I understand or areas that I'm restricted from speaking of because we didn't get to them the first
right.
time. Do you have other questions for me or issues?
We've read your brief and we'll rely on that, but you can't go outside of what the state has.
I understand.
They don't get to talk again.
I understand.
So, any parting comments?
I would just ask the court to, I guess I'll revisit the due process motion because the issue is the exculpatory, and I think the burden, what was said on that was slightly different than the state submitted. Ultimately, we need to know whether the failure to investigate resulted in the loss of exculpatory and material evidence and whether irreversible prejudice and permanent harm happened. And I think the record's clear that by failing to interview the only witness, we can't recreate that. We can't go back and unring that bell, and that's the prejudice and the harm. So